The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Is Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. So, turn up your Walkman, loosen that scrunchie, and get ready to talk 80s with your host, Lindsay Parker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Parker from Yahoo Entertainment and Sirius XM Volume, and welcome to Totally 80s. Since we're all at home, why not take a second to follow us at Totally 80s on Facebook and Instagram, and email us your comments and show ideas to podcast@totally80s.com. And as a reminder, if you want to see our lovely faces, you can catch this episode on video as well as on our Totally 80s YouTube channel, so check that out. And joining me today, as always, is my partner in all things 80-licious. That's not a word. I just made it up. Yeah. John Hughes, the other John Hughes.
80-stastic?
80-stastic. Let's go with 80-tabulous? No. Let's go with 80-stastic. That works.
Right.
So today, I'm excited because we're going to bring you all the fake news, the good kind of fake news, the fakery and chicanery that we enjoy. Today, we are talking about our favorite fake bands of the 1980s, because sometimes, to quote the great Bono, they're even better than the real thing. So yeah, we're going to talk about when all these shows went punk, like Chips and Quincy, The Dregs of Humanity. The spoiler alert, because The Dregs of Humanity is like the greatest moment in television history, not even just 80s. Totally everything, totally all decades. It's like the best thing ever. So let's just dive into it. Did you ever see, I'm curious about this. This is the gold standard for me, John. I'm curious because I know you did not grow up in Southern California or on the West Coast. You grew up in Ohio, correct?
Midwest boy.
Do you remember the Dregs of Humanity episode of It's Your Move? The very short-lived, it was only one season, should have been multiple seasons. The Jason Bateman show, I don't care. Ozark's great. Good for you, Jason Bateman. Ozark's great. No.
Arrested Development, whatever.
Arrested Development was fine. The greatest moment in television history in terms of Jason Bateman's career or life was It's Your Move. Do you remember the show?
Absolutely. No argument here, because my little sister loved Silver Spoons. And the character that he played was like the smarmy, you know, always manipulative brat of a kid. And they loved that character so much they wanted to spin him off, and that was the way to do it. And when it first premiered, it was like this nasty show. And when you realize it was by the same creators of Married with Children, it all makes sense. I was addicted to that show, and the rest of my family hated it. So I had to like fight to watch it. But Dregs of Humanity, I remember because part two was preempted. Yeah.
On everywhere but the West Coast. So here's a nutshell. It was a very special two-part story arc. And I'll say it in a nutshell, that a fake band's created, not unlike the skeletons in the Touch of Grey video by the Grateful Dead. They're made out of actual skeletons from Science Lab. They have to have like a last minute prom band. So they string up these people on wires. They string up these skeletons on wires. And by the way, the guy who played Eli, put upon sidekick of Jason Bateman. Went on to be like some like guy who does like Rube Goldberg machines. Like he did the machines that are in the All Things Must Pass video by OK Go. Like he actually went on to be like a guy who did this in real life. That's why these skeletons were so good.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the Dregs of Humanity.
So they become a sensation, and long story long, it gets out of hand and they have to be killed off in some crazy accident because it's gone out of hand and the ruse is about to be up. And then Nina Blackwood is on and it's an amazing episode. So the first episode was a cliffhanger. with Jason Bateman's character finding out that the Dregs of Humanity, who are storming up the charts with their, it's weird because they had like a boogie rock song. It was called Sweaty Betty, but yeah, they look like all the, like, they all look like a bunch of Eddies, like the Iron Maiden mascot. Like they all look like they would be like a metal band.
Right.
They're all like druid robes with bones. So the Dregs of Humanity get an offer to like for tens of thousands of dollars to headline the Hollywood Palladium.
$10,000. I remember the exact amount.
Nice, nice. So they're going to do it. But then, like I said, they realize that they can't keep up this charade forever. So that's how it ended with episode one. Episode two is where we found out how Jason Bateman and David Garris, the guy who played Norm, not Norm, he was Steve. Was he? No, he was Norm on It's Your Movie. Was Steve on Married with Children.
Right.
They do this plot to kill off the band. So that's how everyone was supposed to find out. But apparently that episode, I did not know this at the time, was preempted in most of the United States, other than the West Coast, by a President Reagan press conference, because apparently America did not have its priorities in the right place at that time. What's more important, finding out what happened to the Dregs of Humanity or whatever the president had to say? I think the answer is clear, John.
That cliffhanger was unresolved for me for 30 plus years. In the pre-YouTube days, I found someone had a complete burned bootleg season of It's Your Move on ioffer.com. And I couldn't hit the checkout button fast enough.
Oh, my God.
Dubs of dubs, four generations down. But you better believe I sat there and watched the entire thing. And I finally got to see the conclusion of the Dregs of Humanity episode years later.
I thought the show was really popular because my sister and I watched it, you know, live, and we knew what happened. It was only till years later when I would be talking to people and no one ever remembered the Dregs of Humanity except for this small little group. I found out that most people didn't get that kind of closure. So we're happy to provide it for you now. I can't find this episode anywhere online. Every once in a while it shows. Do you have that?
I'll hook you up.
All right. Sounds good. So that they were sort of like a metal band that sounded like the Doobie Brothers. And I think they set the gold standard for just an amazing fake band whose like legacy has outlasted the 30 or so minutes it was on television.
All right, the show itself was interesting because it was real proto Married with Children. Mm-hmm. The creators, you know, they always joked that Married with Children was the anti Cosby show. It was like, mm-hmm, exact opposite they went, but they kind of laid the groundwork with It's Your Move. People were nasty to each other. They were underhanded and sneaky until they tried to save the show near the end of the season.
Yes.
Throughout the original concept.
Well, see, the thing was that the Jason Bateman character was an asshole, basically, for lack of a better word, but he always got away with it. Unlike most shows where someone acts like that and then they learn a lesson at the end of the 30 minutes and he never learned a lesson. He got away with it every time.
I prefer lovable scamp.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Either or. But the parents thought he was a bad influence and they wrote complaints to the network, and the network rewrote it for him to get his comeuppance, and then the show tanked after that. But, yeah, you know.
Bad move.
But he was kind of punk rock in a way, which brings me to what I think is actually a subsect of the whole fake band genre. Is this era we had, actually several years too late, TV is slow to get with the trends, about punk rock and how it's bad, and how there was that after school special, The Day My Kid Went Punk.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that. Actually, that actually was it starts off as a cautionary tale, but it actually had a nice message at the end that you shouldn't judge a punk by his cover, and just because he's got, you know, he's wearing a hefty bag and has safety pins in his face, which is how all TV punks look then. He could still be a nice guy. Yeah, there was always a punk episode. Like, there was a Silver Spoons episode where, like, Ricky Shorter goes punk for, like, one episode, and he, like, tears up a shirt, and he, like, literally wears, like, a trash bag, and suddenly he's punk. That's what punk is, apparently.
And spiked hair in, like, leather, mm-hmm, and studs, you know.
Collar from Petco. Yeah,
more like metal. People couldn't get it right.
But there were two really excellent classic punk rock episodes that really have stood the test of time. And they were, you have to mention them in the same breath, the Chips episode and the Quincy episode.
Yes.
Which is your preferred episode?
The Chips one, because the band is much more Fear influenced. The punk band Fear, they kind of give off a leaving kind of vibe.
And now, all the way from the hills of Hollyweird, welcome Pat!
But I remember how that song went. The song, I think it was called Pain, or it was called I Dig Pain. Mm. This is how it went. Take a hunk of concrete. No, 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 no. Shove it in my face. No, 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 no. I like to play with razor blades. No, no, no. I hate the human race. That's a jam. That's an accurate song. I don't know. So the Chips episode, it actually had like a new wave pop band or pop girl named Snow Pink, who was played by one of the eights from Eight Is Enough. I don't know. One of the daughters from Eight Is Enough. And she's like the virtual, like, sweet pop princess. And it's a battle of the bands. And I believe she wins, but she's up against Pain. That's the band you're thinking of that sounded like Fear. Yeah. They were called Pain. Yeah. And they were introduced as being all the way from the hills of Hollyweird, which is factual. That's where punk was. And
It kind of misses the whole social ethos of punk, but okay.
Well, you know, this was 82 when this came out, I think, 82-ish. So you have to remember by then, LA punk, because this took place in LA, had True. Gotten a bit macho and a bit misogynist and a bit
more social D mommy's little monster type.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, you know, maybe there was someone working for Chips who actually did a little research. Meanwhile, over on Quincy, there was the band Mayhem, who had their hit Next Stop Nowhere, which I actually can't sing for you. So I guess I have to agree with you that the Chips episode was superior.
No way out, no way out of the rain. No shortcuts, baby, no fast lane. Ain't tomorrow, only yesterday's pain. So cut your wrist and watch your life go down the drain.
But neither of them were very accurate versions of punk.
Nowhere near. I always like when these shows, when like the star would like appear like in punk clothes, and it was like supposed to be a big shock, like, oh, look, punk is punk now.
They were about as punk as Vivian from The Young Ones. Like, they were sharing the same outfits, but they had a different accent. That's basically where it was. But it was, I just love the fact that it was like all of these, the after school special and these two episodes and all the other kind of like one-off punk things. I guess they were written to like scare parents into thinking, like, if your kid's dressing this way.
Who are they written for? Were they written for the parents? Were they written for the kids to try to get them to watch Chips and Quincy? Why would Quincy do a punk rock episode except to fear-mong? You know, to make parents, because Quincy was like the Matlock of its day. Matlock! 65 plus and nothing but Geritol commercials. So I don't know.
I don't think it was necessary. These were necessarily written to be like, hey, we need to like youthify our demographic. Hey, what are the kids like these days in 1982? Punk's the thing. Let's do a punk episode and then we'll have all the teenagers watching Quincy this week. Yeah, probably not. But we're talking about it, you know, 30 years later. So I guess, you know, they made their mark.
Reasons.
so wrong, it's right. But I noticed, John, you're wearing a Monkees t-shirt today.
Intentionally, because of the theme, you know, although fake band that became a real band, you know, like Pinocchio becoming a real boy. But
you know, can we talk about...
Yes.
Can we talk about the new Monkees?
My name is Helen, and I live with these four rock stars in a house you're just never going to believe.
That's why I kind of wore this.
I took your bait so readily. I am maybe one of the few people who bought the new Monkees record when it came out. Now, granted, you're raising your hand. Us two. Now, did you buy yours from the cutout bin for 99 cents? Because I will fess up to that.
I got mine in the cutout bin for 99 cents on vinyl. I sure did.
So back me up on a couple things. The song, What I Want, is basically laid the template for Walk the Moon, Shut Up and Dance. They're the same song. Listen to them back to back.
What I Want is a jam, an unapologetic mid-80s cutting crew, Mr. Richard Page-ish kind of jam. I'm, you know,
Glass Tiger, all that jazz. Also Johnny vital. Hates jazz.
Yeah. You know, it's a jam. It's a good 80s tune. You know, you got the gated snare, you got everything else going on, but it's a good song. It's well crafted. And you've got The Man Inside the Boy Inside a Man by you know, Mr. Red Ryder himself. Tom Cochran wrote that. Mm-hmm. And you've got really kind of assured, you know, I know I'm going to go on a limb here and say this, really assured vocal performances from Marty Ross and the other guys in the band. I'm going to defend the New Monkeys music.
We'll get to the show in a moment. I think we're on the same page. I'm very surprised because I know obviously you are a big fan of the original Monkees and you've worked with them. And a lot, I'm looking behind, not only are you wearing a Monkees t-shirt, but if you're watching this on YouTube, you got like Monkees Gold Records behind you. I would think because the Monkees fans hated the New Monkees when they came out, hated them. And I actually think that the show was actually terrible, but I do think the show might have had a better chance had it not been called the New Monkees. And it had just, because obviously at that time, the Monkees were having this revival because MTV had started showing old episodes and the Monkees got back together, did this big anniversary tour, like 20 year anniversary tour, and it was a huge success. So they were trying to make lightning strike twice. I feel if they had just called it something else and said, like, brought to you from the creators of the Monkees, this new band called the Whatevers, it would have done better. Because like Marty Ross, as you mentioned, he was from the Wigs. He had, you know, some chops. They had a lot of really good like power pop songs. My favorite song by them was a song called I Don't Know, which in the TV show, the Del Rubio triplets are on the show. It's that song that goes, I don't know how I feel about your... I know all the words.
I don't know how I feel about her. Is it love or only the night? Am I doing this right?
So there were two problems with this. Well, there were multiple problems, let's face it. One, the branding.
Yeah.
Two, the show actually was just actually really not good.
It was ill-conceived.
The guys did their best. They actually had some comedic chops, particularly Dino Kovas actually had some chops. And he actually used to do all these like cable access kind of like little vignettes like Dino's Kitchen, which actually, if there was such a thing as YouTube and going viral then, it was like that sort of short bite comedy sketches. He had some chops. The show was not good. The branding was not good. But also like the actual Monkees were really against it. So like any kind of, and understandably so, it was diluting their-
really, really screwed up because their big brainy idea was to have the Monkees come on the show and pass the torch to the New Monkees and be kind of like, you know what? Hey, kids, you put their arms around them, like give these kids a chance. And keep in mind, the Monkees had just had a top 20 hit. I mean, just months prior, they were not over at that point anymore. Mm-hmm. They were a viable touring entity that were still scoring hit songs and selling records. Why in God's name would Mickey, Peter, and Davey hand that off to a bunch of things, a marketing construct they have nothing to do with yet again, because these guys got screwed over the first time and here they're asked to get screwed over again.
No, because they didn't own the name and now their name is going to get diluted. There's a couple different Monkees. Mickey Dolenz, who I'm sure you know, after the Monkees had a very successful career, mostly in England, directing mostly television shows, right? He became a director. He had actually been tapped to direct the pilot episode of the Monkees. That's what he told me in an interview I did right around the time that Good Times came out, a record that you had a lot to do with. Another one of the many times that the original Monkees have had a revival. And so I asked him about that and he told me that. He basically said, screw you, I'm not directing this. If you want me to direct an episode where we are sort of saying like we're retiring. But there were things about it I liked. One, as you mentioned, the music. Little bits of comedy. And I do actually think the camaraderie between the four guys was real, because I don't know if you know that they're all still friends.
Yes. In fact, there's been a thawing of the ice in terms of the original Monkees and the New Monkees. Marty's joined Mickey on stage a few times for some shows. you know, been some meet and greets where they've kind of gotten together. And there's been a little reassessment of the New Monkees, the album and the music. And there's a fan base there for only lasting 13 episodes in syndication.
It was supposed to be, I believe, 23. And they just like they said, no.
Yeah.
But it's really funny because I may have been responsible for a bit of the thawing because I did an oral history of the New Monkees when they celebrated. Maybe they weren't celebrating, but they were celebrating. I don't know how many people were celebrating. But when the anniversary, I guess it would have been the 30th anniversary happened, I interviewed them and did an oral history. And you could tell that maybe there was a little bit of hurt still because of the fact Dito in particular had been a really big Mickey Dolenz fan. He really, he was a drummer. Dito was a drummer, but he also was a comedian. So he really loved the Monkees. And he tried a couple times to reach out to the Monkees and or to reach out to a Mickey. Like they would be at the same kind of like Comic-Con style signing event. And Mickey didn't want to have anything to do with him. But I think the fact that they just branded it instead of trying to create a new thing, because Marty said this was when he knew it wasn't going to work. He told his mom that he had gotten this gig at the time. It sounded like a really cool gig, TV show. And he said it was called The New Monkees. And she said to him, oh, which one are you going to be? Are you Peter, Davey, Mickey, or Nez? And he was like, ah, crap. Like, that's not what it is. Like, we're not supposed to be. But they did have those roles. There was a dreamy one. There was a funny one. There was a shy, you know, awkward one. They all had their sort of roles. But I like the fact that they've sort of started patching it up. And I did, because I'm a total dork, John, I went to a reunion that they did. Or I guess every 5 years, they actually do an event. And there's this woman who is the biggest New Monkees fan, and she organizes them. And it wasn't big. It was at like a Color Me Mine or one of those kind of places. It was like a pizza party. But there was about 50 people there, some of whom had flown in from other states. The group, you know, did a podcast live, and they had all their memorabilia out, like old posters and things like that. And then they performed an acoustic set of the songs we're talking about. And, you know, it's a very small fan base, but, you know, sometimes those fan bases are the ones that are the most passionate. Because when you find someone who, like, can sing I Don't Know by the New Monkees, like, that's, you know, a soulmate for life. So exactly. I like the fact that, you know, we're sort of contributing to that reassessment. And I do like the fact that none of them in that group have any sour grapes. They're still friends. They've all gone on to do successful things in their career. They're not, you know, I'm sure they wish things had turned out a little differently or been handled a little differently, but they have a sense of humor about it all. And they still embrace the fact that they're the New Monkees. They're not embarrassed by it. So,
yeah. And they've had successful careers after. It's not like it ruined anyone.
No, not at all. In fact, they're all like, Dino is a movie director. We've probably talked too much about the New Monkees, but we haven't talked about Joni and Chachi. Do not want to. Inside me. That was a hit, right? That was a mild hit.
Yes. No?
Ish, you know, you would know what number it went to on the bubbling under chart. It fizzled under the fizzling under chart.
I think it, drowned under. It's that show. Have you ever tried to watch it since it aired, like on YouTube or anything?
Can't say I have.
John. It is painful. I mean, painfully bad. Kind of like I loved Mork and Mindy as a kid. You try to watch Mork and Mindy now, and you want to stab forks in your eyes. I mean,
it's Fork and Mindy.
Fork and Mindy, yeah. It's just, you're like, oh my God. God rest his soul, Robin Williams. It's like, it's annoying.
That show probably would never have lasted like more than a couple episodes if it hadn't been for, you know, the sheer talent of, you know, Robin Williams forcing, you know, making it rise a little bit to the top. Right. But, you know, the Joni and Chachi thing, how many episodes was that?
Oh, I think it was just a season, right? 22 episodes, 23 episodes. And then the Happy Days producers learned their lesson and brought them right back for to the main show, which, you know, poor Lori Beth and whoever Crystal Bernard's character were jettisoned off after one season.
Yeah, Joni, you know, she was no Leather Tuscadero, let's face it. Some other sitcom bands. Do you remember the Permanent Waves from Family Ties? They were good. The Permanent Waves. There's just one episode. This was what was the youngest daughter's name? Teeny others. Jennifer. It was Jennifer's band. They had two songs that were kind of a bop. One of them I can sing right now. It was called "In Love Again." It goes, "Ooh, I'm in love again, in love again, baby, baby." Pretty simple, but it was very like,
yes,
it was very Debbie Gibson sounding. And Christina Applegate was in this episode. It was before Married with Children, speaking of Married with Children. And she is playing keyboards and she's all like Lisa Coleman out. Like, she's got like massive shoulder pads and she's like giving face. It's great. Yeah.
Baby, I'm back in love again. In love again. Ooh, ooh, baby, I'm back in love again. In love again. I'm in love with you.
It's actually not, it's very like mid-period Bananarama. Like before they got with Stock Aiken Waterman, but after they were ska. It's not, the music is actually decent. I didn't really watch Full House, but of course we got to talk about, we got mention at least Jesse and the Rippers.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mullets galore.
Mullets are, not as good as El DeBarge's mullet, but a mullet nonetheless. Do you remember the aphrodisiacs from Different Strokes?
No.
I can't believe I'm stumping you. I never stumped you. Today. Wow. I'm feeling good about myself. I don't know if I should feel good about myself that I remember this stuff. They were a funk band that featured the supergroup lineup of Todd Bridges, his stepsister, Dana Plato, and his girlfriend, Jack Jackson.
Wow.
So the theme, what I remember of this episode, was Todd Bridges is starting a band and he wants to have a female singer. And he doesn't know if he should choose his stepsister, played by Dana Plato, or if he should choose his girlfriend, Charlene, played by Janet Jackson before she was Janet Jackson. Mm. So his very diplomatic solution is to have them both be in the band and then sing Ebony and Ivory. That happened. That
sure,
happened.
Why not?
Ebony and Ivory live together in perfect harmony.
Obviously, Gemma and the Holograms.
Truly
Barbie and they were truly outrageous. Barbie and the Rockers. But most people know about those. I want to ask you if you remember Kid Video with two D's. Of course you do.
Of course I remember Kid Video.
Can you explain to me what was happening with that? Because I feel like someone put acid in my Lucky Charms when I watched that one.
It was, what was the show with Rick Springfield in the 70s where Mission Magic,
Yeah,
it was kind of like Mission Magic for the MTV era. You know, these kids went into this TV set where everything was kind of like music video related. And there was live action, there was cartoon, there was a talking animal of some sort, I'm sure.
Well, from what I remember from my Lucky Charms acid trip, I remember two things. They were playing in a garage, and then for reasons that are never explained, somehow they get teleported into a cartoon dimension in which they have to be musical slaves.
Right.
Like they have to play for some dictator and for the rest of their lives. And was Robbie Rist involved?
Robbie Rist was on that show for sure.
Okay. That happened.
Yep.
Was the music good?
Sure. There was an album. I don't know.
Wait, what? There was a Kid Video album?
Yeah, there's a Kid Video album out there somewhere on Discogs. Pay $400 for it if you want.
Sure. After you buy your new Monkees record. Well, let's move on to, to films. So I think it's obvious that the ultimate 80s fake band for movies is Spinal Tap. I don't even know how much we need to even establish that. But do you remember their UK counterpart?
Bad News. Hey, Bad News.
So that was all the guys from The Young Ones, right?
It was, except for Mike. Mike was not part of Bad News. But you don't forget, French and Saunders are on Bad News as well as the groupies they pick up on the tour bus or the tour van, rather. But you've never seen Bad News. I feel bad because did it predate Spinal Tap or was it contemporaneous? But it's completely.
I was always under the impression that it came afterwards, but that might not be true. I saw it afterwards.
Rick Mayall, Aidan Edmondson, and Nigel Planer from The Young Ones, and they have a metal band called Bad News. And you know, it's kind of a weird universe. The Bad News universe is not quite in line. They're signed to a record label, yet they have no money. They have no budget, but they're dealing with label people and they're on a tour. They got a tour book, but nobody comes to the shows. But then they come to a show and the show is like filled with people. Can we get a streamlined Bad News universe, please?
Maybe they got teleported to the Kid Video universe. I remember the scene where the character played by Rick Mayall, the scene where he apparently he lives with his mom and like someone comes to the door and he doesn't have his heavy metal wig on and he's like super embarrassed. That was a really good scene. I remember bits and pieces of it. Is there a way to watch that though? Is it like, did they ever do a DVD?
There was a DVD that was VHS that was put out by Rhino Video. And there was a DVD that was put out by Rhino Video. And
You got any promo copies of that in your office, Sean?
Long before I started at the company. But it was two episodes of a British TV show called The Comic Strip.
So yes.
That's where the origins of it were. And the trivia that I love about it, they have their music video for Bohemian Rhapsody, remake of Bohemian Rhapsody. And the awful guitar solo on the Bad News version of Bohemian Rhapsody is played by Brian May.
Like he deliberately sucked?
He deliberately sucked. He produced the song and he plays the horrible guitar solo. It's amazing that Brian
May. Oh my God.
Has such a good sense of humor that he did that.
I never knew that. That's amazing. Well, let's talk about another kind of art imitating life, because it started as a fake band, but then actually became it yielded a successful real life band, or launched a successful band, Eddie and the Cruisers. I saw it in the theater. I stood in line at the Galleria Mall to have my 8x10 of Michael Pare, AKA Eddie, signed, but it was not a success. Through the magic of cable back in the days where we didn't have a lot of cable channels and when cable channels got a sort of what was considered first run movie by their standards at the time, they just played it like pretty much in an endless loop for like 3 months, like the Z Channel, Select, on. So about a year and a half later is when the soundtrack, which was done by John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band, suddenly on the Dark Side, this like wannabe Bruce Springsteen song is a huge hit, like way later. And I loved the movie at the time. I'm going to admit, at the time, I was young and naive. That ending just blew my friggin' mind. Yeah. Oh my God, Eddie's alive. I'm sorry for the spoiler if people haven't seen it, but Eddie's alive. Sorry, Eddie did not die. But let's just face it. Everyone loved that John Cafferty sound and stuff. Had that second Eddie and the Cruisers record came out, the one that the record label, the difficult second record, quote unquote, that was inspired by the poet Arthur Rimbaud and Season in Hell. That wouldn't have sold. That would have flopped. That wouldn't have bubbled under. That would have fizzled under. Let's face it. The record label was right.
It would have been the Hooters' second record. Yes.
Did the Hooters do that? Did they go all like? Did they pull a Terrence Trent D'Arby and go all like artsy on their next record?
They had like Johnny B. You know, remember their serious. Follow-up. But the thing about Eddie and the Cruisers, and more importantly, John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band, I'm trying to remember who it was. Somebody did an interview, a musician from that area, from that same area where John Cafferty was from. And they said that movie was the biggest mistake that John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band made, because they were actually a very credible local band there in Boston. And this just kind of ruined their reputation and they became branded as Springsteen clones. And that's not what they really were. I'm going to kind of raise my hand and go BS on that. Cause you listen to the song CITY snore.
Did you ever see the Eddie sequel? I don't know what it was called. Eddie Lives or Eddie 2 Electric Boogaloo. There was a sequel where he comes back from the, the fake dead. No, there is. I didn't see it. I just know it exists because Wikipedia is my friend. But it exists. Apparently, where he makes a comeback, he announces that he never died, much like the myths about like Jim Morrison or Elvis, that he's still alive. And there's a sequel. It's probably not good. I don't know if John Cafferty's involved, but you know what was good? You know what my favorite rock movie of all time is? Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That is such a great, first of all, it's got my icon, Corinne Burns, saying I actually have this quote on my Tinder page. It says, I'm perfect, but nobody in this shithole gets me because I don't put out. I wonder why no one's swiping on me, John. I don't get too many swipes. Don't know. But the one person that gets the quote and swipes right on me, that would be my soulmate.
Yeah.
But Corinne is played by Diane Lane. Mm-hmm. It's like a skunk-haired Laura Dern. They're very Riot Girl. And then there's two great fake bands in this because there's the Stains, but then there's also the Looters, who are played by Paul Simonon from The Clash and Steve Jones and Paul Cook from the Sex Pistols. And then there's a third fake band, the Metal Corpses, which is fronted by Fee Waybill. It is a Coachella. It is a triple bill of actually good fake bands. The soundtrack is amazing on this record.
That's great. You know, and we can't let this go by, especially since you bring up Diane Lane, without mentioning her other fake band, Fire Incorporated, from Streets of Fire.
Streets of Fire, yes.
With their great song, Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, the overblown Jim Steinman production that sounds like a Meatloaf song with the chick from Face to Face doing the lead vocal.
Is that true?
Very true.
Did Diane Lane, did she do the singing for The Stains, or was that dubbed as well?
I couldn't tell you, but I know that the vocalist from Boston band Face to Face, not the punk rock band.
I know who you mean.
1098 fame, did the vocals for Fire Incorporated. And it's so funny because the performance in the movie, it's just her and like this, you know, bar band with a few lead singer or background singers. But you listen to the song, and it's kind of like this Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart, Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell production with like an orchestra and like 30,000 choruses. And yeah, this band on stage is making that racket.
Since we're talking about films that had multiple bands and were sort of a Coachella fake bands, there's one that I think you might know a lot about because Mike Nesmith was involved, and that is Tapeheads.
Hi, I'm Ivan Alexey in Video Aces. We make rock videos. You can have 5 time to look at this or call me. Your name was
Skip.
Ivan, give us a call.
John Cusack.
So there were four fake bands in this. The Blender Children, which was fronted by Stiv Bators from the Dead Boys and Lords of the New Church. Ranch Bone, which was actually just a country fishbone, but doing country music. Cube Squared was a Swedish pop band, fake Swedish pop band, whose scene is them singing in the Swedish language, Devo's Baby Doll, but in Swedish. And then, of course, the Swanky Modes, which was actually, the Swanky Modes were Sam Moore and Junior Walker, actual legends. And then this film, which starred Tim Robbins and John Cusack as fledgling music video directors, was produced by Mike Nesmith. Like, what a part of that isn't rad? So wow. We're sort of running out of time, but there's just a couple I'm going to mention as lightning round. Are you aware of who Big Fun are?
No.
Have you seen Heathers?
Of course.
Did you know that the song Teen Suicide, in parentheses, Don't Do It, was written by Don Dixon and played by members of Lex Active? It was played by Don Dixon and Mitch Easter.
No, but I know now that I had to go listen to it.
I am so proud of myself. I don't ever remember stumping you as many times as I have.
You got me.
And then there's, of course, Sexual Chocolate from Coming to America, which is a big one. And then we have to mention Light of Day, speaking of bar bands, the Barbusters from Light of Day, because not only was their song, correct me if I'm wrong, song was written by, not by John Cafferty, but by the actual Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
It was notable for bringing together the musical soulmates that are Michael J. Fox and Joan Jett, clearly. Yeah. But Trent Reznor was in that band. He's in the keyboard.
Reznor's in it, and it was filmed in my hometown of Cleveland, and I was living there at the time, and it was a big deal that they were filming that movie in Cleveland. I believe the bar scenes were filmed at the Cleveland Agora, if I'm remembering correctly, or the Fantasy Theater, one of the two.
That's pretty rad. Yeah. So the last band I'm going to mention, because they don't fall into any other category, they're not a band from film, they're not a cartoon band, they're not a band from TV, they're just a band from the figment of Disneyland Mastermind's Disneyland Mastermind's imagination, but they're soon going to be part of a film, a documentary called Live from the Space Stage, a Helix story. Are you familiar with Helix?
I am not.
All right, sit down, children, sit back. Prepare to have your minds blown. So this documentary that just like understandably completely exceeded its Indiegogo or Kickstarter or whatever it is, it made more money than it was supposed to be. There is something called Defunct Land. It's the like Disneyland look behind like Disney things that went wrong. It's a YouTube series.
Yes,
they're the ones making this. Helix was, I'm not making this up. This documentary is going to be, it's going to win all the Oscars. So in 1981, they put together a Kiss-like glam rock band called Helix to perform at Tomorrowland on the space stage. There are videos of this on YouTube. They had a song called Jailbait. I don't understand why this would be the case to play at Disneyland. But it's insane that this happened. It was like they were supposed to be like if Kiss were playing in the Star Wars cantina. There's a Wookiee in the band, like a furry creature, like an abominable like snowman or like a Chewbacca type person playing. There's like people dressed in like King Diamond makeup. This was a thing and it only lasted for a year. I think they thought it was going to be like it was going to become a real band.
How did it pass me?
I don't know if it, I almost kind of feel like if you don't know about it, it didn't happen.
Well, it sounds very familiar. Disney, you know, has this huge flop on their hands. Marvel Comics tried the same thing in 1981, being timely as it was, with the Disco Dazzler, which was, a partnership with Marvel Comics and Casablanca Records, where they would have this actress, singer, play the Disco Dazzler, and she would have superpowers and have her own comic book and albums. And eventually Casablanca, you know, in a cloud of cocaine dust, pulled out the project. And Marvel actually went ahead with the Dazzler, no albums, but the Dazzler is like a member of the X-Men and is a mutant now. Wow. So it's like Helix Dazzler kind of failure combination there.
Well, not all bands can be Gem in the Holograms, so let's face it. But Helix, it's called Live from the Space Stage, the story of Helix, and I think it's going to come out this year. And it's I didn't get to go to Disneyland in 1981. So I think that might be the ultimate fake band, a band that only played at Disneyland for less than a year.
I got to hear Jailbait by Helix.
That's your homework assignment for the night. It is on YouTube. And I need to watch this documentary to find out why people thought that was appropriate for a children's amusement park. Sure. But perhaps some mysteries will never be solved. But we solved a few today. And I had a fun time talking about things, the good kind of fake news, even better than the real thing, fake bands of the 80s. I've been Lindsay Parker, and I've been joined by the other John Hughes. And we want to thank you guys for listening. Remember to give us a rate and review on your favorite podcast platform, and we'll catch you next time.
Was Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Totally 80s, and please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until our next episode, catch you on the flip side.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.